Chapter Review, Statistical Literacy, Chapter 7, Randomness and Chance. Now remember, slide 2 here, we have four kinds of influence on a statistic or a statistical association. Remember, take care, each letter designates one of the four kinds of influence. The R stands for randomness, the subject of this chapter. Way back in Chapter 1, we talked about coincidence. Randomness is a very controlled form of coincidence. Gambling casinos rely on randomness. Slide 3. In this chapter, we'll touch on four topics. Number 1. If you've got a random process and an excess builds up, how does it correct? Number 2. How do we use chance to estimate in situations that seem impossible? Number 3. How do we estimate the survey error in sampling due to small sample sizes? Number 4, what is statistical significance and how can we detect it? First topic, slide 4, overcoming excess. Supposing you've got a fair coin. You're flipping it and all of a sudden you see an excess of heads. Should you bet on tails? Must the coin really offset the excess heads with excess tails in order to get back to 50-50? Or supposing you're in a casino, watching a roulette wheel. It's been giving an excess of reds. Should you bet on black? Must the wheel offset with extra blacks to get back to 50-50? No. A coin and a wheel have no memory. They have no power to offset. Offset is impossible. So how do they return to 50-50? By dilution. They just do 50-50 in the future, and any excess gets diluted out, becomes smaller and smaller in hindsight. So, how can we use statistics to get answers to things we wouldn't expect? We want to ask people questions involving sensitive issues, things that they've done that were wrong or illegal. They have no motive to say yes. We must convince them that if they do say yes, that no one can tell whether they are telling the truth. We're going to randomly and secretly assign them to two groups without anyone else knowing, even the researcher. For example, we could say all those born in odd months are in group one, all those in even months, group two. Or all those with an odd number of letters in their middle name are in group 1, even in group 2. All those in group 1 are told to always, always say yes to the sensitive question. All those in group 2 are told to answer truthfully. Now the people in group 2 realize their yeses are going to be masked, hidden, concealed within all these group 1 people that are required to say yes. So we encourage all those in group 2 to say yes. When appropriate, and otherwise, say no. Answer truthfully. Look at the table in slide 5. All we need to do is to fill in the two numbers in the lower right corner. Total number of subjects and the total number that said yes. With randomness, we assume the two groups are going to be equal sized. Having an even number helps here. And that everyone followed the instructions. Once you've completed the table, you go to the second column, tell the truth, and you can obtain the fraction of the truth tellers, second column, who said yes. This is better than hypnosis and it's legal. Now you need a large group to minimize the error. Slide 6, adjust for guessing. I'm not going to go into this slide. There's no Moodle questions on this slide this time. The bottom line is maybe the only takeaway. If you're taking a test where you penalize for guessing, you guess any time you think your chance of being right is greater than 1 over the number of answers. So if there are 5 answers, If you feel your chance of being right is greater than 1 in 4, guess away. Slide 7. How do you estimate the size of hard-to-count populations? I'm going to use the example from biology of fish in a lake. This is before we had fish finders. Or the number of birds or insects in a population. Or the number of homelessness. The number of homeless. So, first of all, you obtain a random sample from the population. You mark these or identify them in some way, release them back into the population so that they are well mixed. And then you draw a second sample. Some of those in the second sample are going to be marked or identified as having been in the first sample. That proportion in the second sample, marked to the size of the second sample, that proportion is the same as the proportion of the entire population that were in the first sample. From this algebra, you can figure out the size of the population. Amazing what statistics can do using randomness. Third topic, sampling error. We take samples to save money. The cost is error. How much error are we going to have? Well, statisticians have worked out the following. They work in terms of something called margin of error. It's the average error that you expect with a certain level of confidence. Now, without knowing any formulas, intuitively, we're certain of one thing. Sampling error decreases as sample size increases. In the limit, if the sample is the entire population, there is no error. What's non-intuitive is the sampling error is proportional to 1 over the square root of n, where n is the sample size. Now, most people don't think well in terms of square roots, so we can convert this and say, if you want to cut your error in half, you need to double? No. You need to quadruple your sample size. And since cost is typically related to sample size, that means 4 times the cost. Here's the business trade-off between benefit, reducing error, and cost. What's most counterintuitive? Number 4, the sampling error is independent of the size of the population. It doesn't matter whether the sample is this class, this college, this city, this state, this nation, or the world, as long as you can get a good random sample. Slide 9, confidence intervals for proportions. Let's see, 4. Six, eight. No, slide 9 is for proportions. Amazing. The confidence interval for proportions in exact form is 1.96 times the square root of p times 1 minus p over n, where p is the sample proportion. I don't memorize that one. But there's a conservative form that's a lot simpler. 1 over the square root of n. It's conservative. It's a little bigger than the previous one, but it's a lot easier to memorize. Remember, n is the sample size. So if we're sampling 900 people, square root of 900 is 30. 1 over 30 is my margin of error. That's about 3%. Actually, 3 percentage points. And this conservative value is what is typically reported in surveys. Now, the confidence interval is simply your sample statistic, the proportion in this case, and then plus or minus the margin of error. So if we had a survey with 900 people, and 40% of them were in favor of something, we'd say the confidence interval was 40% plus and minus 3 percentage points. Newspapers show it as percent. But typically we know the difference. Slide 10. Continuing on with surveys, what about subgroups? Again, let's assume the survey has a margin of error of 3%, and we're dealing with a subgroup that's a fraction of that. To get their error, which is going to be larger because the group is smaller, we need to divide by the square root of the fraction that subgroup is to the whole group. So, if the subgroup is 9%, 0.09, the square root of that's 0.3, we take our overall survey margin of error, say 3 percentage points, divide that by 0.3, and suddenly we've got a 10 percentage point margin of error. 10 percentage points. It increases. Slide 11. Measurements. Measurements, or averages, is how we often encounter them. Again, the confidence interval is the sample statistic, in this case the mean, plus or minus the margin of error. And the simple margin of error is just 2 times the standard deviation, which is S in this case, divided by the square root of N. So as you can see on the slide, we've got 100 students and they average 8 hours of work per week with a standard deviation of 5 hours. And S, 5, 2 times 5 is 10, divided by the square root of 100, which is 10, gives us a 95% margin of error, 1 hour. Our confidence interval is the sample statistic, 8 hours, plus and minus 1 hour. Pretty straightforward. Slide 12. What sample size do we require if we want to have a margin of error that's going to be smaller than a given maximum? The slide gives an example with proportions conservative, proportions exact, and the third one, the margin of error involving measures or averages. Since this isn't in the text yet, it's not going to be on any Moodle quiz assignment or exercise. But those marketing people that are going to take market research, this slide is critical. Slide 17. No, that was slide 13. Right. Statistical significance. What does it really mean? This is our fourth topic. It means it's unlikely if it's just due to chance. Supposing you're playing a friendly game of cards and you realize you haven't had a good hand all night. Maybe 10 deals. And you're saying, this could be coincidence, or it could be somebody's stacking the deck. We're saying, if it's less than one chance in 20, statistically, it's significant. You should pay attention to it. In flipping a coin, 5 heads in a row, one chance in 2 to the 5th, we're saying, that's really unlikely. Is this flipping really random? Or you get dealt a hand where you've got, say, 3 aces. You're happy, but you're wondering, is this whole game really fair? Now, these exceptions are going to happen. They're not impossible. They're just statistically unlikely. That's all that it means. Slide 14. We say that they're unlikely in the case of confidence intervals. If we've got 2 confidence intervals, one from group A and one from group B, if they overlap, we say the difference in the sample means or proportions is not statistically significant. If they don't overlap, we say, this sample difference is statistically significant, This is good evidence, strong evidence, that the difference in the population statistics, proportions or means, is likely to be real. This is our inference from sample to population. Now, you have to realize that when you say it's statistically insignificant, doesn't mean it isn't, there is no difference. We'll come back to this one. I guess we did slide 14 right there. Slide 13, which I kind of skipped over here, mean if you talk about being statistically insignificant, no, if you talk about being statistically significant, the bottom of the slide there, it means it's unlikely if it's due to chance, but it does support the claim that the outcome is more likely to be due to something other than chance, that it could be real. That's what gets our interest. So, moving on to slide 16. Is statistical significance necessary? No. Not always. In some cases, where you're trying to show something new is safe and beneficial, then the presumption is guilty until proven innocent. It's the flip of the criminal case, but it's a high standard. We don't want to put in drugs that aren't effective. But in newspaper polls, there's no reason to assume this strong standard. We use the civil law standard, preponderance of evidence. And so if one candidate has a higher proportion than the other in a two-party, in a two-person race, we presume whoever has a higher proportion in the sample has the higher proportion in the population. Newspaper will call it a statistical tie. Gets people's interest. But there's no reason to assume the high standard we use in medical procedures. Slide 17. Slide 18, actually. So what explains statistical insignificance? There are two different kinds of explanations. One is, there's no real difference. The observed difference that you're seeing in the samples is spurious. It's just an accident. Or, number two, there is really a difference in the populations. But the sample size is too small. There's too much noise. We can't see the difference. A common error is to forget about the second of these. Final slide, reviewing randomness. Sampling error is often overlooked. If I had a bumper sticker, it would be see coincidence or see chance. A statistically significant association isn't necessarily important, and an insignificant one may be pure coincidence, or it may be a small real association that's just getting lost in the noise due to a small sample. That's it for Chapter 7.